Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Today I report on an economy set to grow faster than any other major advanced economy in the world.
Well, that was George Osborne. I, however, am Nate Langson. This is Text Message.
And I'm Ian Morris.
First and foremost, in fact, this week, I wanted to spend some time really looking into what the UK budget means for the tech sector, and specifically as well for anyone who's interested in tech. And the normally the budget, and this year certainly was no exception, is not usually heavy on tech. And it's a little bit of a dry document to go through, but go through it I have. And I think we've broken down here, and will break down for you here, the key points. But we're going to start with the sharing economy support. Now, this is an interesting one, Ian, because it means that from 2017, next year, obviously, there will be two new tax-free allowances worth £1,000 a year to British citizens. Now, what's that got to do with tech, may you ask? Well, one of them, one of these tax breaks, essentially, is going to be for selling goods or providing services. Now, this could be anything from having an Etsy shop to running a small little craft business on eBay, selling art, prints, things like that, up to £1,000. It's a tax break. And the other is for providing sharing services. This is things like Airbnb, ride sharing, renting your driveway out to drivers if you have space and maybe live near a train station, which is something I found out I can do in my new house that I've just bought. And the Daily Mail, in a rare moment of balance and matter-of-factness, described this as a tax break for Airbnb and eBay entrepreneurs,
yeah.
Which... one of the first times I've ever fully agreed with an entire Daily Mail sentence.
A whole sentence is incredible stuff.
Absolutely, and credit where it's due. You know, once in a lifetime is worth pointing out. But that is what it is. It's, you know, if you are somebody who is considering trying to make a bit of extra money on the side by renting out a room on Airbnb, running your business on eBay, Etsy, some of these types of platforms that are quite digital first platforms, you know, they're very mobile first. They require a little bit of web savviness. It means that you're not going to pay any money on the first £1,000 that you make from those activities. No forms to fill in. In fact, that was a direct quote from Osborne, who says that it's in the same way. The first £1,000 of income from property, renting a driveway or loft storage will be tax free. No forms, no refunds. Just don't bother paying tax on that. That seems great.
Awesome.
To me. Would you agree?
Yeah.
Ian? Is this something you would want to take advantage of?
No, I've got any room. But yeah, I mean, I suppose anything you can do to encourage things like this is probably a good thing. I mean, this is how you kickstart entrepreneurship and get people thinking about how they can make money on things that are otherwise unused, be that a driveway or a garage or, you know. I don't know. I feel like, well, there's a lot of things that I would rather see money get spent on, but I think this is fair enough. It's a new industry, isn't it? So it's worth encouraging it.
It is, and the devil will be in the details in terms of how widely this affects. I mean, how the loopholes that could be applied could be for things like, well, podcasting. Let's take podcasting as an example. What if I make £1,000 from the podcast? I don't, by the way. Neither does it.
No, I don't make anything. Not a bean.
But you know, could we say that is you know, somehow selling a good that we have made?
I'm not sure,
but if it's a digital good, maybe that's a thing. You know, it's they describe these people as micro entrepreneurs who sell their services online or rent out their homes through the internet. So chances are that this small amount of money is not quite big enough to warrant people being really hassled for at the best of times, and so they're probably not paying it anyway.
That's my theory.
This just removes the burden of stress from people and maybe encourages them to get going. So I think that's great. And apparently, according to Osborne, it's a tax break for the digital age, and at least 500,000 people will benefit in the UK. So I can't argue with that. 5G, Ian.
Yes,
that's next on our list here. Exciting to you and I. We are network fans.
Very much so. So it was all over my World Congress this year, actually, 5G. I had a nice chat with Qualcomm, a slightly more confusing chat with a gentleman from NTT Docomo. But yeah, it was talk of the show in some ways.
Well, it's been the talk of the budget, at least if you are a networks journalist looking for the key detail to write a story about, because the budget this year included a paragraph that says that the commission will carry out an assessment of how the UK can become a world leader in 5G deployment and how it can take early advantage of the potential benefits of 5G services. This review will include a case study of the southwest of England. So again, this is something that's going to take place probably over the next 2 years, between now and 2017. And although 5G is a long way off, you know, some people...
2020, I think, is the date.
Well, that's the date, I think, at the very earliest that we will see any kind of application of it. Yes, but we're probably talking 10 years from now for us all having...
There's some good life left in 4G yet. We haven't eked every piece of performance that's possible out of that yet.
Definitely not. But the fact that this is in the budget is encouraging, because it means that whether anything comes out of it or not, someone is paying attention to it, and it was worthy of inclusion, and it's something that's been identified as important, which is great, because a lot of talk around 5G is not how fast you can download your TV shows or albums. It's actually more often talked about Internet of Things and the ability for cars and small devices to very quickly interact with each other. And although we're not going to talk about Spectrum on this, it was mentioned in the budget that Spectrum is going to be made available for a variety of new services, and this could connect into that literally in this case. That's exciting, I think.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we need to, this is something that I think industry should pay for, really, but I guess it's always good to have studies done. And you know, obviously there is a broadband problem in this country that needs to be resolved, and 5G and 4G will help with that.
Well, actually, also in the budget was about, I think, £4.5 million to be spent on broadband in the southwest. So yeah. Broadband is, in fact, let's jump to that, because this is a whole separate thing. There's a bigger number we can talk about as part of this. The government has announced that, in partnership with the private sector, is going to establish a new broadband investment fund, or BIF, if you will. This fund will operate on a commercial basis to support the growth of alternative network developers by providing greater access to finance. The government will distribute £14.5 million in grants to extend ultra-fast broadband coverage in the southwest. So the southwest, obviously being pinpointed here as an area that needs better broadband. It's also the area where this 5G study is going to be done. So I think there's a lot we can read into here, that the government really sees 5G as the way of leapfrogging into the next generation of broadband, as opposed to just mobile services, which is smart, because long term, it's better than laying a lot of cables around. But it also seems that it could take quite a while, and we're going to have to work with the private sector to develop some of these new products. But overall, that seems like a positive thing to see at least promised. Next, we did mention the Internet of Things, the cities and cars and things. And last week, I think it was on last week's show, we talked about driverless lorries, driverless cars. That's the next point that was in the budget that was relevant to the tech fans of Britain and the world, which is that the government has announced that it's going to establish, it wants to at least, the UK as a global centre for excellence in connected and autonomous vehicles. The government will, I'm reading here straight out of the budget, by the way. The government will conduct trials of driverless cars on the Strategic Road Network. Not entirely sure yet what that is. By 2017, so within the next year. is going to consult this summer on, quote, sweeping away regulatory barriers that exist within the current parliament that it would enable autonomous vehicles to be driven on England's major roads. It wants to create a £15 million connected corridor between London and Dover that would, I assume, have some sort of internet of things, internet of cities, wireless points throughout the journey that allows cars and infrastructure to talk to each other as a way of seeing if that benefits drivers and business, as well as do the what it calls truck platooning on the strategic road network, which goes back to the autonomous or semi-autonomous lorries and trucks that we talked about last week. But quite interesting, because, I mean, Britain isn't doing a lot in the space of developing driverless cars. A lot of that's being led out of the US. But we do want to make sure that we're benefiting from that and allowing you know, these companies to either potentially sell their technologies in Britain, sell them to British drivers, as because British drivers want to drive them on the roads because they've been allowed to. So,
yeah,
again, this seems like a you know, quite a long-term goal. But again, some money being put into making research possible to do this and to make it safe. But I'm curious about what would constitute a major road. You know, autonomous vehicles on England's major roads. That's a direct quote out of the budget. Now, Ian, would you call a major road sort of a motorway? Or
yeah, I would. Yeah, definitely.
A motorway.
I would say it's got to be motorways. And the other, I mean, obviously, I would be quite in favour of this. And there's one very good reason that a driverless truck would be quite useful. I mean, obviously, it would help reduce costs because drivers are not allowed to drive for, you know, over a certain amount of hours per week and stuff like that, which is obviously very difficult. I suspect that driverless trucks would only be able to do certain runs, so probably only up and down motorways anyway. I think asking them to drive, I mean, I'm sure it's possible, but I would say at least to start with, that's a lot easier, isn't it? But of course, driverless trucks don't get impatient. And what you see on motorways, and this causes huge snarl-ups, is that when one truck overtakes another truck, one of them going at 60 miles an hour, one of them going at 61 miles an hour, that takes a long time and blocks up two whole lanes. And that could be two-thirds of the whole capacity of the road.
Yes.
So it would be good to get away from that and have autonomous trucks that are just happy to sit in the inside lane and do their thing and, you know, get on with their lives without blocking up other lanes.
Well, before we get to that point, we are going to have to see this consultation in government this summer about changing the regulatory barriers, as at least as Osborne sees them, that exist within government to at least allow some of this testing and piloting to take place. And then from 2017, actually be conducting these trials of driverless cars on the roads. The government will establish a panel of leading experts chaired by Catherine Parsons to shape a £20 million Institute for Coding competition. And this institute, as research turned up, is going to be run by the Department for Business Innovation and Skills, which is a good start. The details of exactly sort of how this Institute of Coding will work and what it's got to do with these academies potentially that we're going to have by 2022 and obviously with the UK universities, those details seem still to need to be fleshed out a little bit. But I looked into where this last came up, and this came out last year in April, where it was announced that this Institute of Coding, brackets Center for Digital Skills and Computer Science, seems to be aimed at breeding people who may want to work at GCHQ one day. And in fact, there was a speech given by George Osborne last year where in the very first paragraph says, Britain must be prepared for ISIS, to develop the capability for cyber warfare, Chancellor of the Exchequer George Osborne warned in a major speech at GCHQ. But it was in this document that he said, the government will launch a competition to attract joint collaborations between universities and business for a capital prize of £20 million focused on the digital skills and computer science. That's what's now been confirmed in the budget as being available this year. So what I can take from this is that it's a pot of money the government's putting up for grabs for individuals, universities, and private businesses to get together to generate, to get people new skills and offer them either jobs or incentives or some kind of return fees as a way of getting great computer coders staying in the UK and potentially working to combat terror at GCHQ. Now, that amount wasn't put in the budget. That's all from my sort of background reading today. I don't know how I feel about the coding being so very closely paired to cyber warfare and counterterrorism, but more coders in Britain and a bigger emphasis on computer science in general seems to be, to me, a smart move. Ian?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, one of the big problems that we're going to have increasingly is going to be, and this is always going to be a problem, is talented people will get taken to other countries. Obviously, places like China and India spring to mind, and of course the US. So it obviously makes sense to keep people here and also deploy them for use in, you know, counterterrorism, I guess. So yeah. it's a good idea. I don't know how exciting people will find those jobs, whether or not they can compete with the likes of, you know, coding for Facebook and stuff. But I expect it's probably quite high up in terms of interest levels.
Well, there's now £20 million as a reason to be interested. So I think that's good, and hopefully will help develop at least some new educational ideas for getting coding into schools and universities, which is no bad thing.
It isn't at all. And I would be very disappointed if if any school wasn't even if it was optional making coding available for kids, because it's natural for them. They can easily learn it. They'll have the advantage that I don't, because I've never been able to pick up a programming language because I'm old and doddery. But it would be great if kids can be taught it at school and walk away with something that will actually be, even if they don't end up being coders, that's always a valuable skill to have, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. I mean, it's not been too long, but it's been around for a while now that there is a GCSE computer science, which I think is either compulsory or is at least a part of your educational. Which is for those of you outside of the UK, that's the grade, the studying you would do between the ages of 15 and 16 in compulsory education. And computer science is a part of that, that I think touches upon apps and, you know, more advanced computer studies than just here's how to use Excel, here's how to use Word, which, to be fair, you all know how to use anyway. So maybe this is the next step for that. We'll see. I want to move on just before we get up to the 20-minute mark talking about this. We've got one more aspect to this, which I find a little bit more interesting than some of the other things in the budget, just because it's going to open up a whole load of new possibilities for people to think about money and to not be put off by working with banks anymore. This is the government's intention to work with what's called the New Bank Startup Unit to promote the authorization of more new banks. Now, you might be thinking, more new banks? Terrible idea. We've got enough bankers and their bonuses ruining the country and the world economy. What does more of those bring to the table? Well, banking licenses, it turns out, are very rarely issued, and Metro Bank is one of the only new high street banks for over 100 years in the UK. It took about 2 years for that company to get a banking license. Whereas, while we've been going through all this, we've had the mobile revolution. We've got people doing banking on their phones. We've got people paying for contactless payments with Apple Pay, with Samsung Pay, with Android. And so people are using their phones as wallets and as a conduit to their financial management platforms, whatever they're trying to do. And there are now apparently as many as 24 firms trying to get licenses to be a bank, officially a bank, licensed by the government to be managed and run as a bank with the responsibilities that entails. And the Chancellor has said that he wants to grant 15 new banking licenses in the UK in the next 5 years. And that was said last year. So that's up to 2020, 15 new banks. And there are a number of these starting to pop up with promotions. There's one called Atom Bank. That one's not live yet, but it wants to be digital only and wants to be an online-only current account. There's another one called Fidor Bank that is live, and it's a sort of a social media web 2.0-based bank, so they call themselves. Has a bigger emphasis on sort of customer relationships on social media platforms. It's actually been around in Germany for I think nearly 10 years, and Russia, and it wants to launch next in the UK and then in the US. There's another one called Starling, which again isn't live, but is being set up as a digital bank, and that wants to be, I think they wanted to be live by last year, but they're particularly interested, I think, in how things like Amazon and Apple have worked to make music downloading and shopping incredibly easy and painless and sort of free of hassle from dealing with real people. And they want to apply similar sorts of thinking to banks. And then there's another one I saw called Lintel, which again isn't live right now, but it wants to really put sort of high-tech IT to and mobile into the sort of the forefront of the banking experience, if you like, and do everything from current accounts to mortgages and loans and all that sort of stuff. These are just a few. There are loads more. And apparently one report I read said there's as many as 20 or two dozen that are trying to get some of these licenses that Osborne's promised. So this, I think, is good news for tech people because London's fintech community is massive. Financial technology companies get huge amounts of investment. It's one of the most highly invested in areas of technology startups in the country. And London is a real hotbed for that sort of innovation. So with the combination of a promise to better support these sorts of businesses and the promise to issue a whole load of new licenses and being in a country that is particularly notably innovative with financial technologies, I think that's great for us. And I think that, you know, if that helps even shake up some of the other more established banking players to pull their acts together and not disillusion people into putting cash under mattresses, then
yes, I mean, that's good. That was my point, really, was that, you know, the banking is fundamentally, it's very difficult to find a bank that does anything differently. So it would be good to see if these can encourage banks that are able to offer different services, able to offer better interest rates, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And give people a reason to be excited about banking again. They're never going to be excited about
definitely.
Banking.
I mean, I've just gone through the process of buying a house, and it's a tedious, laborious, and stressful process involving huge numbers of human beings and a lot of fanning around.
And Very much so.
What I would love to think in the future is that we could have a could you imagine a mobile experience that combines the ease of sort of getting insurance through something like Compare the Market or Go Compare with your bank, with your, say, Rightmove or one of the online estate agent type thing, and being able to have the entire or at least the majority of the whole process of buying a house done in a single app? Because that's kind of the direction that we're going to. And these sorts of announcements and plans, again, trying to be as just plain and objective as possible, these plans at least are the kinds of things that can help us get a step or two closer to that. So personally, I'm very excited about that. And hopefully the next generation of house buyers won't have to deal with some of the BS that you and I have to deal with presently.
I pity you because it is awful.
Yeah.
But hey, you know, you only have to do it a couple of times in your life, I suppose.
This is true.
There is that. But it is a complicated process, and it's steeped in very pointless traditions as well. Stamp duty.
Don't get me started on stamp duty.
It's been around since the tax.
Yeah, but it's been around since the 1600s, and no one's ever really been able to give a good explanation of what it is. They don't even put a stamp on anything anymore. Even the thing it's named after, they don't do.
Don't you?
Anyway, well, that's our wrap-up of the budget. Through the eyes of the Tech Observer, I hope that's given everybody a good overview of sort of the highlights of tech and digital. But let us know what you think to any of these things. 5G, the Institute for Coding, the cyber education stuff, driverless cars, the sharing economy. If you're planning on taking advantage of being able to, you know, make £1,000 every year from renting out your driveway or selling on Etsy or eBay. And of course, things like the Broadband Investment Fund, being a new bank, that sort of stuff. Let us know what you think. I'd love to get some views and digest this a bit further. podcast@natelangson.com. We will eagerly await your opinions there. And now, before we move into a little bit of feedback and the second bit of news we've got for this week, it's time to check in with Tom Merritt of DTNS, see what's been happening this week and what's coming up next week in the global tech picture.
Hey, thanks, Nate. Coming up this week, we'll be talking on Daily Tech News Show about Apple's announcement on Monday about products. And does anybody care about that when Apple's fighting the FBI in court on Tuesday? This past week, we talked about whether anyone really cares about their privacy, even though they all say they do, and whether chatbots will will be the next wave of innovation after apps. Also talked about high school team robotics, how that's changing kids' lives, and the virtual reality landscape. What is this stuff good for now that Sony's in the game? All of that on DailyTechNewsShow.com.
Thanks, Tom. All good stuff coming up this week. And do check out Tom's show, DTNS, Monday or Tuesday and or Tuesday for a breakdown of the Apple announcements coming out Monday evening. Obviously, Ian and I will be dissecting that with hawk-like precision and detail next weekend. But if you want something sooner than that, obviously tune into DTNS on Monday or Tuesday. A little bit of feedback here. We've got one from John, who emailed in after our episode last week about Tetraphobia and the Samsung stuff, who says, you mentioned Microsoft, but you didn't mention how they released Windows NT and Windows 95 at the point where Windows 4 would have been appropriate. It's very true. Again,
it is true.
Whether that could be directly attributable to wanting to not put the word death in a product title when released in China, we don't know.
That is a good point, because it was NT5, wasn't there, which was which became Windows 2000, didn't it? So they really did miss 4 out.
Yeah, it was completely missed, and we missed that last week, and so thanks, John, for pointing that out. Meryl tweeted us and said that she'd just finished listening to the podcast, got to the comment, Tetraphobia in the East, but fear of 13 in the West. Hospitals and hotels often don't have a 13th floor. A room marked 13 often either doesn't exist or it's a cupboard. Not sure if it's that frequent nowadays, but do think it had an impact on marketing. So we do have our own fears too. Very true. We actually, we were going to mention the 13 stuff, but we went on for ages last week, so we didn't.
But, we did, yes.
But thank you, Meryl, for pointing that out. It's very true. So who knows? Will we ever see OS 13, Windows 13, or... you know, just a 13th floor in a hospital. Don't know, but we'll keep our eye on that. Keep the feedback coming. podcast@natelangson.com, or obviously tweet us at textmessagepod on Twitter. And of course, do keep those wonderful reviews that keep us bouncing around with giddy excitement. I tingle from nose to tail, Ian. Nose to toe, sorry. You know, it's
you do have a tail,
indeed, it's an all-encompassing tingle. That's the depth to which I get excited when I see people leaving us reviews on iTunes, because that's the way that people discover the show. So thank you ever so much to all of you who keep on doing that. One last story we wanted to get to here, Ian, which is that, well, it's that Microsoft and PlayStation, Sony PlayStation, may at some point, it seems, cross their networks over. I mean, that's extrapolating. Do you want to go into a bit of detail about what this is, Ian?
Well, curiously, this came from Microsoft, didn't it?
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I don't think anyone's really been desperately asking for a feature like this. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's been the gamer's desire all along. But the idea is that finally, people who have PlayStation 4 will be able to play co-op games with people who have Xbox Ones and the like. And I believe when I asked you, you said that you suggested that would also go to PC gaming as well, so that us glorious PC Master Race people would be able to play the console peasants at their locked down 30 frames a second.
It's not always 30. It is 60. But
it is 60 for some games. Yeah, absolutely. And I speak as a man with a GPU. It's not quite quick enough to run a lot of things at 60 frames a second anyway.
Yes.
But even so, I think it's a nice idea that we could potentially have a global way of playing games across whatever platform. Now, I don't even know why this has taken so long. It doesn't feel to me like it would be particularly difficult, but then I don't know anything about how the back end works on these systems. And
well, you don't need to. All you need to know is that Microsoft and Sony want to control their own networks to get a competitive edge over the other.
Yeah, this doesn't really affect that, though, does it? I mean, allowing one set of players to play with the other is not a big problem.
I think it's probably a slight nod to the fact that people are more frequently wanting to play with games where it's more than just two players. You know, it's games that have many, many players, and in order to consistently make sure that you've always got a critical mass of players ready to play together, you kind of need to think outside of just who's on Xbox Live right now, who's on PlayStation right now, who's on PC just now. And this is something that's been around for, you know, for a while. Final Fantasy XI back in the day actually let PlayStation 2 players and PC players play together. It was a massively multiplayer online role-playing game, It was the first multiplayer Final Fantasy game of its ilk. It came out around 2004, I think, 2005, something like that. And it was kind of revolutionary. The people could play between PS2 and PC. And at the moment, Final Fantasy 14 has continued that, and people can play between PS3, PS4, and PC on that. One of the games that was highlighted as part of this announcement from Microsoft is Rocket League, which is kind of a casual racing slash football slash crash into cars game that's very exciting. It already lets people play between PS4 and PC, but now it's going to also let people play between Xbox One and PC. Microsoft said, according to this Ars Technica write-up, that there's an open invitation, that is a quote, for other networks to get involved, not just with Rocket League, but with the opening of Xbox Live. And part of that, or rather as a result of that, Sony has said that it's looking at potential benefits of having cross compatibility with Xbox, and it's something that they're interested in. In fact, I think this report also noted Street Fighter V could benefit from this, or does already benefit from this as well. So, you know, I don't think they're outwardly saying yes, this is great, PlayStation would love to partner with Microsoft, but the fact that both companies are sort of coyly nodding, knowing the other one's listening, that maybe it wouldn't be the worst thing if some of their games or some of their networks or users could work with the other. You know, I think that's a good thing. If games get more multiplayer, you know, there's nothing worse than buying a game a couple of years after it came out, wanting to play online and finding the experience to be, for want of a better term, piss poor, which does
very much so.
Which does happen. This is a way of at least saying, well, you know, if there's only 5% of people playing versus what there was when the game came out 2-3 years ago, then, you know, it doesn't make sense for that 5% to be split across PS4 and PS3 and Xbox and PC. It would make sense to, in the long term, fuse these together to allow these multiplayer games a longer lifespan, because that's better for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. And I imagine that it will have some cost benefits for companies as well, because they won't have to run whole groups of servers that will be used by one or the other. They'll be able to consolidate that down. I mean, obviously, as a gamer is popular, then they'll need more servers, obviously. But I can see that could give games online longer lifespans, because they won't be under so much pressure to shut down those expensive servers, I would guess.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is great. If Sony's happy to have that conversation, which they said they are, and Microsoft's making that a possibility, then we're all winning. And this is competition at its best, isn't it? This is where the customer wins, and that's what's great. Well, that's going to do it for this week's text message. Do obviously check back next week, where we're going to dissect what comes out of Apple's announcement Monday, the 21st. There we go.
21st. It's tomorrow, Nate.
The 21st. We decided not to do a preview for this because probably most people listening to this podcast have kind of already previewed it themselves. So instead, we'll just come back with a giant big egg of our opinions and crack it over you in a week's time. So let us know.
It'll be interesting, won't it? I mean, I'm excited. We'll see.
I am. I did read a report today, I think on Pocket Lent, that the iPad Pro might, the 10-inch one, might not be a direct replacement for the iPad Air. And in fact, there may be an iPad Air 3 and an iPad Pro 10-inch, and the 10-inch would cost more money and just be higher end, which I think would be desperately confusing, and I hope they don't do that. But we'll check back. Let us know what you think between the announcement and next weekend. If you want to comment on the announcements, podcast@natelangson.com. Ian, it's been nothing but a bucket full of pleasure.
Agreed, absolutely.
I have slurped ever so deeply this week.
And well done for braving the budget. That was quite the undertaking.
Well, hopefully everyone appreciated it. See you guys in a week.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.